Today is Monday, June 16th, 2008. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I'm an interviewer for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I'm interviewing UW-Madison Professor Emerita of History and Liberal Studies, Margaret Beatty Bogue. Dr. Bogue received her PhD from Cornell University in 1955. She started her career at Vassar College and also spent a year at the University of Western Ontario. In 1966, she joined the University of Wisconsin Extension, where she worked until 1983. At that time, she moved to the UW-Madison Division of Outreach, and in 1989, she also joined the Department of History. She retired from the university in 1991. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to start this interview by asking you about your early life, where and when you were born. Describe your childhood, your early schooling. Talk about any family members, teachers, or others who encouraged you in your studies.
Thank you. I was born in Washington, D.C. on June the 14th, 1924. And in the years 1924 through 1935, I lived in McLean, Virginia, in the family home on an 11-acre piece of land complete with orchards, barn, garden, and chicken house. McLean was a very sleepy little rural village in contrast to today, now an upscale Washington suburban commuter community of mega residences and commercial buildings. The family moved to Beltsville, Maryland in 1935 to reside on the U.S. Department of Agriculture Horticultural Experiment Station, where my father temporarily abandoned his scientific work in order to take charge of developing the newly created station. We moved to Cheverly, Maryland in 1944 at the beginning of my senior year in university. As for early schooling, I attended Franklin Sherman School in McLean, Virginia, first through fifth grade, and then went to sixth and seventh grade at University Park Elementary School in College Park, Maryland, and then to Hyattsville High School in Hyattsville, Maryland, 1937 to 1941. Those who encouraged me in my studies included my parents, who both put a high premium on education, all you could get. Teachers, truly, all my teachers did. Most notable teacher was the American history teacher in high school, Adelaide Clow. I had always loved history, and she was a major influence in my decision to major in history at the university. As for my undergraduate work, I did my undergraduate work at the University of Maryland, College Park, Maryland, 1941 through 1945. In truth, I did not make the choice of where I would go to college. It was always assumed that I would go there. Given the Depression years, the necessity for economy, I could live at home and thus save a good deal of money and minimize costs all around. My parents financed my undergraduate education, and I did have, in retrospect, it seemed to me, I had a very fine undergraduate education at the University of Maryland because it opened new doors of thinking and new attitudes to me that I had not had before. I was very, very determined to work hard and get the highest possible grades. I began in the School of Education thinking of becoming a high school teacher. I found education courses boring. And in the second year, I switched to the College of Arts and Sciences, focusing on history as a major. I decided I would shoot for college or university teaching and thus planned to go on to graduate school. The undergraduate years were a time of truly expanding horizons for me. They challenged me to think about my mindset on political and social issues. I changed from being a conservative to a liberal, from acceptance of the ideas that blacks were inferior and that segregated society was appropriate. And I came out of my undergraduate experience believing that these people should be treated as equals. In other words, equality became my attitude as opposed to inferior status. It was the influence of my teachers, the coursework, and the various terrible anti-black episodes I personally witnessed. I might just mention one of those in passing because it's so vivid. While living on the U.S. Department of Agriculture Horticultural Experiments Station, my father, who was in charge of things, hired a very, very fine black man who was to be, he had a kind of superior position in the workforce, supervising other workers and so on. And he gave him a house to live in there on the property. And one Sunday afternoon, as we were getting ready to go in to the symphony concert at Constitution Hall in Washington, a car drove up to our back door. A man got out of the car, waving his hands, yelling and threatening at my father to the effect that he had better move that man out of there or he was going to burn his house down.
Oh my goodness.
So that's a sample of the kind of thing that made me understand what terrible, terrible kinds of discrimination, violent kinds of discrimination existed in our community.
Can I ask what happened?
My father went to him and he told him he deeply regretted having to ask him to move, but he thought that he should for the safety of himself and his family.
Yeah.
And he moved. Another vivid memory of undergraduate days was World War II, how it cast a shadow over virtually everything we did, going to university in the dark and watching the sunrise from the chemistry lab window, and worst of all, seeing the flag at half-staff as I walked from the bus stop up the hill to class after Franklin Delano Roosevelt died on April 2, 1945. As a senior, I worked as a Red Cross nurse's aide on Saturdays in the local hospital, Prince George's General, and that too was a very educational experience. There I also learned more about the terrible, terrible things that were happening to black people in our own community. The idea of majoring in history for me at university was just a kind of a natural. I'd always loved it, I think in large part because I grew up with it. The Civil War was all around, evidence of it, old battlegrounds. The War of 1812, Dolly Madison had fled from the White House to a rather attractive brick residence that was not terribly far from our home. And also, there was a great lot of talk about Mount Vernon, Monticello, and so on and so on. And so there was you kind of were living in history when you lived in McLean, Virginia, and the people there who are still, believe it or not, the really old residents are still hark back to the Civil War days. It's just amazing. The emphasis on Virginia history in grade school and the wonderful history teacher in high school also inclined me toward a majoring in history. At the University of Maryland, I had very fine young historians who all went on to become professionally outstanding in the field of American history. Two were University of Wisconsin products, Frank Friedel, biographer of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Kenneth Stamp, Civil War and Reconstruction, and the third, Richard Hofstadter, Pulitzer Prize winner in American intellectual history for his Age of Reform. They were all there in College Park, Maryland, to take advantage of the rich resources in the National Archives and the Library of Congress as they were beginning their careers in a scholarly way. They were also very fine classroom instructors, and I should mention that Frank Friedel, whom I had as an undergraduate, remained my friend throughout his lifetime and is he who got me my first job at Vassar College. My most notable course was a pro seminar in historical writing taught by Richard Hofstadter, who was then working on the American political tradition. He introduced me to original research and whetted my appetite for more. Graduate work. Well, where and why? I went to Cornell University to do my graduate work in Ithaca, New York. The idea that I wanted an Ivy League degree was part of The reason for that, in my state of ignorance and without the benefit of advice from any of my historical friends and history professors, I sent off an application to Columbia, one to Columbia University in New York City and one to Cornell. Both offered assistance. Cornell's being the most generous, I accepted it. I had no really well-formed ideas about what part of American history I wanted to concentrate on, but I did have some fleeting thoughts about doing something with the Civil War, but I wasn't really terribly serious about that. I chose Paul W. Gates as my major professor. He was a very lively, outgoing bundle of energy in his mid-40s, very enthusiastically absorbed in research, a person with contagious enthusiasm. And at that point, he was deep into Midwestern land policy with his research interests. He was given to strong criticism of student reports and seminar. He was tough. He was demanding. For example, he insisted that an acceptable doctoral dissertation should be ready or all virtually ready for publication right away, that would be an important step in any young historian's career. And right he was. This was in the mid-1940s, just after World War II, when women's role in society was strongly dominated by the ideal of domesticity. Woman as wife, mother, and homemaker. Women in most professions, as university faculty, as business executives, as pastors, as doctors, in politics, etc., were not ideal women. Professor Gates had married a Harvard University history major who was still working on her doctoral dissertation. He believed women would make fine history faculty and gladly accepted women graduate students. He never gave up the idea in his long years of directing graduate work in American history at Cornell and saw 7 women through to the PhD, 6 of whom ended up as tenured faculty in major colleges and universities. He was a rare bird during the decades before the women's rights movement, when many male graduate directors frowned upon women as a bad risk and a waste of time. I was very fortunate to work under his direction. And you know, I just stumbled into that. I didn't know that about him, but I found that. And I think that was remarkable. Absolutely. Other very influential faculty there at Cornell were Robert Cushman in constitutional law, in which I had a minor, and John G.B. Hutchins, professor of economics, another minor, deeply interested in economic history and had written on the American maritime industry. I was a teaching assistant for Paul W. Gates' huge American history survey, and that involved teaching discussion sections, office hours with students, and grading exams. I was required to give one lecture to a full class because he wanted to find out if I could do it. He put all his graduate students to that test.
Uh-huh. Obviously, you could do it.
As for research, Professor Gates put me to work on a document collection he had recently acquired for the Collection of Regional History while he was doing research in Illinois. This became my master's thesis. It was an exciting experience working with personal documents supplemented with search in the National Archives. For my doctorate, I used the master's thesis as a launching pad for a much broader project on land use and tenure in the Grand Prairie of Illinois in the late 19th century. My good fortune was to receive a research training grant from the Social Science Research Council and a jointly held a doctoral fellowship grant from the American Association of University Women. This financed a full year of research in Illinois. The dissertation was published in 1959. As for coming to Wisconsin, I came to Wisconsin as a faculty wife. In 1950, Alan Bogue and I had gotten married. We had been colleagues, co-workers, and fellow graduate students at Cornell since 1947. He had come to Cornell from London, Ontario. I had come to Cornell from Washington, D.C. We both still had to complete our doctoral dissertations at the time of our marriage. After 12 years as first an assistant and then an associate professor of history at the State University of Iowa in Iowa City, he was hired here at the University of Wisconsin as a historian of the American West to replace Vernon Carstensen. I had no job offer, but had decided that after 12 years away from formal professional position, I should return to teaching right away, or all was lost. But at that time, I was 40. And I came with hope of finding such an opportunity here. During those 12 years, we had both completed our doctoral dissertations and on a personal level produced three wonderful daughters. Both of us had seen our doctoral dissertations published and well-received in the profession. He pursued career, job, research, teaching, and publication tasks. I felt strongly that I wanted to stay full-time with our children until they were in school before returning to professional employment. A risk? Yes, a risk, but it was well worth it. In the fall of 1964, our youngest began kindergarten at Randall School here in Madison. As for positions held before coming to Madison, following my year of research in Illinois, I had taught 1949-51 at Vassar College, and as I mentioned, it was Frank Friedel who helped me get that job. The courses there were the U.S. Survey, American Cultural History, Recent American History. Excuse me. In 1951-52, I taught on an ad hoc basis English history at the University of Western Ontario, London, Ontario, where Al had taken his first faculty position in 1949. As for the UW hiring process, it was truly unusual in terms of what we think of as UW hiring the process. My entry was not traditional in any sense of the word. I began as an ad hoc instructor for the University of Wisconsin Extension, which in the mid-60s conducted an extensive evening credit course here in Madison. I taught U.S. History Survey. I was hired to do it simply on the basis of my academic credentials. There was no formal hiring process. In the years following my ad hoc night teaching in 1966, my responsibilities at UW-Wisconsin Extension grew and changed. In early 1967, I received a half-time appointment as assistant professor heading the history unit in the statewide extension program. Duties in that position included supervision of the history correspondence study program. And the correspondence study program at that point in time was very large and very important, much more so. It's dwindling in importance now, but it was very important at that time to many, many people who could not really handle attendance in classes on campuses. This involved hiring graders, finding authors for study guides, primarily from among the Madison Campus History Department faculty for the college-level credit courses, finding authors elsewhere for the high school-level offerings, and supervising graders. Graders for college-level credit courses came from the ranks of the Madison Department's graduate students for the most part. The same functions became my responsibility for the work this history unit did to fulfill the U.S. Armed Forces Institute contract with the University of Wisconsin, a very large program generating tens of thousands of pieces of written work, lessons and exams to be graded, critiqued, and returned to servicemen both in this country and abroad. This was a sizable administrative responsibility for the military that lasted well into the 1970s when the military decided to shift their educational work more toward classroom instruction rather than through the correspondence study. As for promotions and changes in appointment while here at Wisconsin, I can summarize them this way. I was an instructor from 1966 to 67, assistant professor 67 to 71, associate professor 71 to 76, professor 76 through 91, full professor. These were within Extension or in the Department of Liberal Studies Division of Outreach, UW-Madison, beginning in 1983. I held a joint appointment with the UW-Madison Department of History 1989 through 91. It was a 25-year climb. I retired in July of 1991, and I will explain the climb.
Okay.
as we go. My work with the Extension and the Division of UW Outreach was truly unique, a most unusual appointment in the sense that its requirements were ever-changing and called for all different sorts of teaching and administrative experiences under the general umbrella of serving an educational role for the people of Wisconsin, both traditional and non-traditional students. The challenges of designing and redesigning the format of offerings and often completely changing content, experimenting with what would and wouldn't work, those challenges, they were always there. And it took a great deal of thought to try to figure it out. My superiors left such decisions to their faculty, suggesting what seemed to them to be general areas where they might consider in programming as worthy of attention. Given the kind of state funding our segment of the university received, my administrative superiors had to keep close watch on how well the required income that we generated from our courses and our teaching met fixed goals. There was no fixed formula such as teaching a given number of classes at stated times, directing graduate students, and making professional headway with research and publication, as was the case with more traditional types of appointments within the university. My work entailed a good deal of evening and weekend teaching, a lot of traveling, at times on the road for several days in order to carry out what was needed for one particular program, and emphasize the on-site instruction as one traveled with the group. That, in general, is a description of the non-credit type of thing. The administrative tasks, aside from those that I've already described in connection with my appointment to a tenure-track faculty position, namely in with reference to the correspondence study program, both the universities of the Correspondence Study Program and the U.S. Armed Forces Institute. The other administrative things that I might mention, I was chair, Department of History, University of Wisconsin Extension, 1967 to 82, associate chair, Human Resources Development, 1976 to 83. It was a large unit, including humanities, arts, government, and sciences within Extension. I was chair of the Department of Liberal Studies, Extension, and Madison Campus Division of Outreach, September 1987 to June 1988. Grant writing to secure funds for the program was an important function of administration while I was in these positions. I was successful in securing six grants that had served as director for them. Two were from the Wisconsin Humanities Committee, three from the University of Wisconsin College Sea Grant Program, and one from the Dane County Cultural Affairs Commission. I served as co- or assistant director to two federally funded grants, one a cooperative effort with the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Education, and the other a UW College Sea Grant Program project, twice funded by the Wisconsin Humanities Committee. And now on from administration, and we'll talk a little bit about teaching. Teaching went along with administrative work. Basically, I taught two types of offerings, non-credit programs for the general adult public and traditional classroom on-campus credit courses for Extension and for the Madison campus departments. The credit classes taught for Madison campus departments were History 397, United States, 1917, 4 credits in 1979. History 390, History of Wisconsin, in 1980, 1984, 1987, 1988, 1989, 1990, 3 credits. Integrated Liberal Studies, 225, American Society, 16-7 to 1900, 4 credits, cross-listed with the History Department in 1977, 1978, and 1979. Prior to the spring semester of 1977, I taught History 101, 102, and 397 for the University of Wisconsin Extension Madison night class programs. So the classroom teaching component was always there. That is the credit type, mm-hmm. along with the rest. Mm-hmm. Need to take a little break. The non-credit adult education offerings taught included 1, 2, 3, and 4 day field trips in Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, Indiana, Michigan, and the province of Ontario, lecture series and workshops on various types of various topics in American history for the general public. I usually taught 10 to 12 such offerings per year, but was responsible for programming and administration of those offerings I did not teach. I worked closely with the UW College Sea Grant Program, the Wisconsin Humanities Committee, and the Wisconsin Historical Society, both as a consultant and as a teaching participant in a number of their projects. I also did a number of lectures around the state on history topics as requested by other campuses of the UW system, libraries, senior citizens groups, and various branches of the state and federal government. Given my background in American history and Midwestern regional history in particular, plus the necessity of creating programs that would appeal to the general public, capture interest, and demonstrate how history contributes to understanding the present, I had to experiment with ways to accomplish this. Mine was a background in traditional classroom teaching, where the students were a ready-made degree-oriented body of students, a captive audience, if you will. Non-credit, non-traditional students were a different matter. Persons who came forward because they were interested in the content of a particular offering, the non-traditional students were a pure delight. They came by personal choice. They were eager, attentive, full of questions. They spoiled me. Trial and error over time revealed their general categories of interest. They were interested in generally in current events creating widespread deep public concern, in the history of communities, in the history of very memorable major events in the state and in the nation, past and present, major figures in state and national history, immigration and ethnic history, main themes in the development of Wisconsin's natural resources, and they were interested also in the histories of major cities in Wisconsin and in the nation. Examples of programs arising from current developments are, there are a few of them here. My introduction to non-traditional students came with the Civil Rights Movement. It involved a summer institute in integrated history for inner city teachers, a cooperative effort with the UW School of Education. I taught a series of offerings in Black history for Madison teachers, did an all-day program for Madison school district principals and administrators, and wrote 2 3-credit study guides for the correspondence study program on Black history in America. Another facet of the Civil Rights Black History effort involved identifying a group of speakers and discussion leaders who could respond to requests for programs. For the most part, advanced UW-Madison graduate students fill these particular needs. Requests for programs came for the main part from schools around Madison and General Madison area, and also at a considerable distance. Another very large programming area was certainly the National Bicentennial. That one was huge. We just did all kinds of things. And then a third example of general public interest created by major contemporary developments was the spearfishing controversy in the Lac du Flambeau-Minocqua area of northern Wisconsin in the 1980s. And a lot of different types of programs came out for public consumption as it came out of our department for public consumption as a result of that. Examples of programs for hometown communities. Most notable example, certainly in this category, came from Madison. The public here had an almost inexhaustible appetite for information about Madison's history, offered in different formats, lecture series, walking tours, combined lecture, lunch, and bus tours of the city, year in and year out. Here are some examples of programs about major chapters, incidents, and figures in state and national history. Non-traditional students were attracted by the French, the age of the French exploration, the fur trade, the lead mining frontier, the Black Hawk War, the Civil War, immigration patterns and immigrants, the lumbering era and its aftermath, and so on. Abraham Lincoln, Cordelia Harvey, John Muir, Robert M. La Follette, Belle Case La Follette, Frank Lloyd Wright, and Zona Gale were ever attractive. There was developed a very, very strong interrelationship between my credit teaching and non-credit work. It was kind of a symbiotic relationship, if you will. It developed as a result of the fact that I was using credit classroom materials to bolster what I was doing with these programs for the general adult public. Mm-hmm. And in doing them, I picked up all kinds of data that would help with the work in the classrooms. They kind of intersected. What I did whenever I went out, for example, to plan a tour, 1, 2, 3, 4 day tour, on-site instruction, take the camera, you go out, you run the road, and you find out just exactly what routes to take, where to stop, where to eat, where to stay overnight, all that kind of stuff. And along with it, you just take tons and tons of photographs. And I took them in slide format. And that was the age in which slides were the thing in the classroom. And then I would use that material in the classroom as it fitted into the kind of information that I was trying to get across to students in the traditional setting. And they loved it. They loved having illustrations to go along with the lecture so that they could see some of these places that we were talking about. So this was quite interesting how the two of these worked together, and one supported the other. In the non-credit area, I soon learned that walking tours and journeys to various historic locations appealed to many. I came to feel, rightly or wrongly, that I managed to get more across to students by taking them to the natural setting where events had occurred. For instance, I offered a 4-day field trip tour, the Lake Superior Fur Trade, where the major destinations were Grand Portage National Monument close to the Canadian-American border and the historic Fort William at Thunder Bay, Ontario, both exceptionally fine places to learn about the French, British, and American fur trade in the mid-continent in the late 18th and early 19th century. Bus travel allowed time to fill in essential history background for such visits, as well as to talk about the area through which we traveled. Of course, this meant careful plans for food and lodging along the way and a test run of the route and the facilities. I always proceeded with camera and film and made plenty of slides. All field trips required this kind of preparation for things to run smoothly, as well as to do similar adventures, whether on foot or by bus. Careful planning and timing always paid off, and contingency plans were an essential if something fell through. Other experimental delivery systems used in the non-credit area included WHA radio. I did a considerable amount of radio work, and the educational telephone network. Now, a lot of people would go, huh, now hearing that mentioned. The latter was provided by a specially designed telephone network that provided communication between the instructor and the students. The ETN outlets were located for the most part in the cooperative extension facilities located in county courthouses throughout the state. In credit teaching, three times, 1987 through 89, I taught an in-class televised 3-credit History of Wisconsin course using the television facilities of the School of Education on the Madison campus, designed especially for the benefit of public school teachers. It was taught and recorded in the classroom in the evening in 2 90-minute sessions per week during the semester, with discussion sections and in-class exams. Those not attending on campus could view the taped lectures on television. They had to come on campus to write examinations, and classroom attendance ranged from 150 to 200 in those particular 3 TV offerings. The taped TV lectures were then broadcast over public television stations in Green Bay, Wausau, Eau Claire, and La Crosse for continuing education units in 1988 and 1989. History 390 televised thus served both credit students and the general public. And that was a very successful experiment. That worked really, really well. Experimenting with the correspondence study program. Now, the correspondence study program had been a long-established thing when I came upon it. It was well-used, but it seemed like there might be ways in which it might be improved. And in the 1970s, I attempted to broaden the appeal of correspondence study courses by introducing new ones which address the history of current social issues. In the addition of the Black History courses I've already mentioned, others were American Women's History. We had one in the 1970s. And Nancy Schramm Dye wrote that for us. She is now president of Vassar College. Huh. And she was a PhD here at the University of Wisconsin, and she worked with Professor Paul Glad, who had left years ago and went to the University of Oklahoma. But at any rate, we had that history course in there, and then we tried to arrange for a Native American history course, and then we also added independent reading offerings, and this would be, you could earn credits by independent reading. And that meant that, and we followed the formula of the Madison History Department in requirements. We always tried to keep these things in sync, mm-hmm, with the Madison Department, and university credit was given for this credit work that we did in extension at that time. I don't know how it is now, but it was true then. But at any rate, what we did was we introduced independent reading. And this turned out to be, it's one of these things where you tailor make a special course of readings for a student who has requested readings in a particular area of interest. And they're responsible for getting the books that you assign to them. Mm-hmm. And they have to write, in essence, reviews of the books, and then they have to explain how these help them in some particular respect. A lot of this was from teachers who wanted to know more about X, Y, or Z. Sure. And also a fair number of prisoners liked this, and they also did a lot with our correspondence study courses. Now, I understand that the prison system doesn't have this component now of allowing them to work for degree credit. But it did in the time that I was there. Mm-hmm. And it helped a lot of people who were in special circumstances or very circumscribed circumstances to get information and help them to think and study and read and just have their minds very busy expanding the body of knowledge that they had. So we were very glad to do it. It was a bit of a challenge at times, but it worked. And another improvement thrust involved revamping the well-established correspondent study offerings to give them greater depth by adding taped lectures to the standard study guide format, which was a study guide and a prescribed set of books for them to work with. And we were able to do that with these taped lectures that had been broadcast over WHA radio.
Mm-hmm.
And those tapes became available to us, and we were able to use them as an added dimension of the correspondence study. So it wasn't all read and write. It was read, listen, and
mm-hmm.
write.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to work out fairly well. The most successful experiment of all, I attempted to add interest and vitality to the 2 4-credit American History Survey courses. This work was made possible by a grant from the Annenberg Foundation. The new American History Survey involved adding a taped component to each of 26 units of study. Each tape related to an event, an individual, etc., within the subject matter of the unit of study. For example, the Salem witchcraft trials was the topic for one. Paul Boyer did that one for us. The Pullman strike, the civil rights movement, and so on. I chaired the Academic History Advisory Committee for the project, which selected the historians and others chosen nationwide to provide essential subject matter for each tape. Worked with WHA radio personnel who created the tapes, and they just did a beautiful job. This was drama.
Oh, sure.
It was a combination of some of it was lecture and some of it was drama. I also wrote the study guide for both the 2 4-credit courses. This was a challenge indeed, but each of the courses received an award for meritorious independent study courses from the National University Continuing Education Association. Experimenting with the delivery systems available in the 1980s was stimulating in the 70s and 80s and enjoyable. Now, of course, technological advances have made my kind of TV, the ETN, that is the Educational Telephone Network, old hat. Computers have vastly improved the delivery systems and gotten to many, many more students nationally and internationally. The great technological advances have changed completely the methods of getting courses to people who can't be on campus. And now something about my research and my research interests. My research interests came from the work I did in graduate school, which related to the agricultural development in Illinois in the second half of the 19th century. The main themes included the way government policies influenced the relationship of people to the rich natural resources of the Grand Prairie and how, in light of economic change, these relationships changed during the last half of the 19th century. Those main themes of how government policy and economic change have influenced the relationship between people and natural resources have remained the central theme in my research, with the addition of a consideration of how resource use has affected the environment. Without a question, my experience with non-traditional teaching at Wisconsin created that additional dimension. Driving all over the state and adjacent areas brought my attention to the results of people's past and present use of natural resources. The extensive work I did with the University of Wisconsin College Sea Grant Program made me aware of the Great Lakes as a highly significant water resource in need of extensive study. I shifted my research and writing emphasis from agriculture to the lakes, although the two are so intertwined that inevitably they must be considered together. The work with UW College Sea Grant Program greatly influenced me to make the change and is in large measure responsible for my last 3 books. I owe them a very great deal. And I might add here, and it should be known, that it was the UW College Sea Grant Program that stepped in and provided a very large subsidy to help this most recent book of mine on Lake Superior to be done in color.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you to them.
Yes. Right. Thank you, UWC Grant. Here are a few thoughts about significant developments in my field of study and my contribution to it. Great Lakes history for decades has centered on political and diplomatic themes, primarily including issues related to the boundary between the two nations, the international law of the Great Lakes, the naval warfare on the lakes during the War of 1812, shared canals, the St. Lawrence Seaway, water diversions from the lakes, especially the early diversions of Lake Michigan to serve the needs of a growing young Chicago. The major overall treatment of Great Lakes history came with the publication of the American Lakes series in the 1940s, edited by Milo M. Quaife, 5 volumes, one for each lake, authored by a highly competent professional historian. None of these considered the effects of human use of the Great Lakes region's natural resources, rich resources of copper, iron, timber, game, fish, and water. Written as they were before widespread interest in the conservation of natural resources evolved into the environmental movement, and environmental history in turn arose from the environmental movement. My recent work has been in the area of Great Lakes history with environmental emphasis. It attempts to trace the relationship between people and natural resources and to show how and why exploitation of the region's rich abundance has impacted the lakes and the region's environment more broadly over the centuries. The Great Lakes region has been neglected as a field for environmental history until recently. Part of the neglect stems from the transnational character of the lakes and the region, which requires research in both Canadian and American materials. And another reason for neglect is the preoccupation of American environmental historians with other areas of interest. For some decades, American scholars have dominated the field of environmental history in North America. In other words, they dominated what the Canadians were doing. But in October 2007 issue of the Environmental History, we find that the whole thing was devoted to environmental history in Canada. And among others, it contained an article calling for a focus on Great Lakes regional research, undertaken as a cooperative effort between environmental historians in both nations. When I began my work on the lakes in the 1970s, I chose to view the lakes as a geographic unit, and I have continued to use this framework. Also, it became apparent early on that the fisheries were a largely neglected subject, and I resolved to study that once I had retired from teaching at the university and had the time to dig intensively into Dominion Archives and National Archives. The central task was to explain the reason that I adopted for this particular study was the central task was to explain the reasons for the change in species and overall decline in the fish population of the Great Lakes from the time of exploration on. When I finished the detailed study titled Fishing the Great Lakes and Environmental History 1783 through 1933, published in 2001 by the University of Wisconsin Press, I turned to completely rewriting a publication which was designed to appeal to the general adult public. And the result was Around the Shores of Lake Superior, published in 2007 by the University of Wisconsin Press, with very substantial support from the University of Wisconsin College Sea Grant Program. I kept the same focus. The lake is a geographic unit, politically divided between the United States and balkanized among the states in the U.S. And in tracing the history of people living in the Lake Superior region and developing its rich natural resources around the shore shows how development has affected the natural environment. What do you consider to be your most important contribution to your field? My list of questions asked. Well, I think Fishing the Great Lakes and Environmental History, 1783 to 1933, is my most important contribution because it developed a neglected subject area in Great Lakes history and because it created an integrated Canadian-American history of the lakes, transcending their political divisions, treating them as a natural geographic unit that they are, a remarkably rich natural resource for the people of both nations. And how did I manage to do this research? Where did the money come from? Well, again, I was very fortunate in receiving support. The Social Science Research Council, American Association of University Women, got me off to a good start with their funding. I mentioned earlier to get the doctoral dissertation research done. I received a Charles Warren Center for Research in American History Fellowship at Harvard, February through June 1972. I was given a sabbatical leave, 1985-86, by University of Wisconsin-Madison and University of Wisconsin Extension. And from the University of Wisconsin Graduate School Research Committee, I received one semester of salary support and travel funds in 1988-89. And these were all extremely important for me. And now we come to this very, very interesting question of the climate for women on the Madison campus. How does it help or hinder the participation and advancement of women? Well, the climate for women on the Madison campus, 1966 to 91, the years when I was party to it, as I see it, was in a state of gradual change due in large measure to the influence of the women's movement. The climate varied from department to department. Women's salaries were in general low compared to men's. Their acceptance as colleagues in male-dominated departments depended on the attitude of the majority. Of course, in disciplines where women traditionally dominated, the issues also differed. Many administrators regarded faculty husbands and wives of those hired well-credentialed and anxious to find employment, to use their talents and education, as the spouse problem. Yet departments, when some extra instructor was needed, often dipped into the qualified pool of hopefuls for limited ad hoc arrangements at a bargain price. As a general rule, the pool of husband-wife hopefuls got referred to University Extension for possible employment. Speaking from my limited personal experience as part of the spouse problem, I found University Extension to be a place where I could be involved in teaching and in a limited amount of research when it was possible to find outside funding or if I was on sabbatical leave. To my good fortune, a colleague of mine who headed the Women's Unit in Human Resources Development was Kay Clarenbach, a PhD in government and one of the founders of NOW, the National Organization for Women. To my further good fortune, my dean, Harold Montross, and his close associate, Theodore Shannon, both highly approved of the goals of the women's movement. Meanwhile, the Madison Campus Department of History, where Alan, my spouse, was a full professor, found itself in need of someone to teach the History of Wisconsin course, given the retirement of Professor Nesbitt, who taught it. They were lukewarm about hiring a person to handle the course. They did not consider it important, and that was simply a fact of their thinking, a part of their thinking. The department hit on the idea of having me do it for them. I did this repeatedly in the 1980s, arranged on the basis of a salary transfer to Extension Madison Campus Outreach in compensation for teaching time. There, the tradition of all-male department had been broken in 1972 with the appointment of a woman, Diane Lindstrom, to the faculty, and it was a big faculty, somewhere between 50 and 60 men, and she was the first woman. Maureen Mazzawi was added in 74, Gerda Lerner in 1980, and Florencia Mallon in 1982. Gerda Lerner came to establish a women's history program, and Florencia Mallon's appointment marked the first husband and wife faculty in the department Steve Stern, her husband, had joined the faculty in 1979. My own appointment, a joint appointment, came in 1989. The change came in large measure due to the efforts of John Cooper and Linda Gordon. The department currently has two husband and wife tenured members. An earlier effort had been made to give me a joint appointment, but that one had failed, and this one that came along in 1989 worked. How times have changed from the early part of the 20th century, when the department had balked at letting Lois Kimball Matthews Rosenberry, a Harvard PhD under Frederick Jackson Turner, teach American history, and refused to let Louise Phelps Kellogg, another history PhD, serving as librarian at the State Historical Society and past president of Mississippi Valley Historical Association, now called the Organization of American Historians, teach a course in American history. They wouldn't let them in. The American Historical Association directory in 2006-07 showed the Madison History Department with 14 women and 32 men as full-time faculty. And that's a very, very big change. As for membership in professional organizations, I currently belong to the Organization of American Historians, the Wisconsin Historical Society, the Minnesota Historical Society, the Agricultural History Society, the American Society for Environmental History, and the North American Society for Oceanic History, which, interestingly enough, considers the Great Lakes as part of their province and has twice had me come and do programs for them. And now a few words about honors and awards. Here, I'm not going to repeat the items mentioned already in the discussion of how my research was funded, but here is a partial listing of honors and awards. Distinguished Service Award, University of Wisconsin Extension, 1980. President, Agricultural History Society, 1984. Wisconsin Library Association awarded me the Outstanding Achievement Honors for Around the Shores of Lake Michigan, a book that was published in 1986. University of Wisconsin Extension Award for Excellence in Teaching and Scholarship, November 1986. National University Continuing Education Association for two meritorious independent study courses in April 87. Wisconsin Historic Preservation Review Board appointed by a historian as a historian member by Governor Thompson in 1989, and I served from then to 94. I received the Van Hise Outreach Award for Excellence in Teaching, University of Wisconsin-Madison, in April 1991. Life after work is the next category.
This is probably the longest part of the answer you've got from everything that you've done since you retired.
First of all, family. We have three daughters, Susan, born in 1953, Margaret, born in 1956, and Ellie, born in 1959, two grandchildren, one graduating from high school in 2008. We just attended his graduation ceremony in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Rachel, who is finishing her first year in high school this year. Susan is a psychiatric social worker, having earned her bachelor's and master's degrees from UW-Madison. She has worked on the front line since graduation in the mid-70s. First in Wausau, then in Eau Claire, then at DeKalb, and currently at the Sinisippi Mental Health Center near DeKalb. She is highly motivated and very dedicated to helping her clients. Margaret earned her bachelor's degree here in performing arts, piano. She is a financial planner and broker for Merrill Lynch and continues with her piano, giving a recital every spring. She and her spouse, Paul, another UW graduate with a bachelor's degree in performing arts, flute was his instrument, are both very much musicians at heart. He also works in the financial world as a computer programmer and frequently performs in a variety of situations, church weddings, nightclubs, etc. Sax is his second instrument. Ellie and her spouse, Steve, both earned bachelor's degrees here in journalism and both served as picture editors for the Daily Cardinal. Both have worked as newspaper photographer reporters since graduation. Very recently, Steve left the newspaper business and took on the job of development director for the Fort Wayne Performing Arts Center. Both Ellie and Steve teach photography for the Fort Wayne branch of the University of Indiana-Purdue. Ellie is working on a master's degree in journalism and has just co-authored a text for photography students. They are the parents of the two grandchildren. As for work and family, balancing work and family proved to be a very difficult juggling act. I always seemed to be in search of a way to do what I felt was essential for each, but I never felt satisfied that I had the right formula. I was extremely fortunate in having two immediate supervisors, Dean Harold Montross and Theodore Shannon, Chair of Human Resources Development. Both of them believed that family was important for their faculty, and they expected them to look after their needs, even if it cut into traditional hours, knowing full well, as they did, that we worked overtime many, many times on nights and weekends. Also, they were willing for me to take special leave in order to go with the family to Sweden for the fall semester of 1968 and in 1973 to spend time with the family while on a fellowship, thus keeping the family together while Al was at Harvard for that semester. Both of the time in Sweden and in Concord, Massachusetts were very pleasantly memorable learning experiences for all of us. Above all else, I was extremely fortunate in having a husband who wanted me to continue my professional life after marriage and who lent immeasurable help along the way. Our children felt the impact of having two professionally oriented parents, made the best of it, and turned into fine adults despite their parents' shortcomings. During my normal one-month vacation time as a family, we went on camping trips in the West and to our cottage at Blue Lake near Minocqua, Wisconsin. We acquired the Blue Lake property in 1968, and following our return from Sweden, began construction of the cottage, a process spread over the years. Hiking, swimming, canoeing were wonderful Northwoods experiences for the three daughters, and all of them still enjoy the beauty of the cottage, perched up about 90 feet in the trees above the water's edge. The Minocqua location made possible extended canoe camping ventures into the Sylvania Wilderness, the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore areas, as well as visits to the Lac du Flambeau Ojibwe Reservation. When we recently considered selling the property, we met a loud chorus of, "Don't do it!" And indeed, they are all planning to spend time there this summer. Are you still working in your field? Yes, I'm still engaged in research and writing in Great Lakes environmental history. Since retirement, I've completed the two books already mentioned, Fishing the Great Lakes and Around Lake Superior, both published by the University of Wisconsin Press, which incidentally also did the Lake Michigan book, which I did in 1985. I still do presentations on these topics when requested. I've continued to work with the University of Wisconsin College Sea Grant Program, the Wisconsin Historical Society, and the Wisconsin Humanities Council to give papers at professional meetings, to write book reviews, and to do some radio and television work. Fun and relaxation in retirement. Walking, caring for, and helping at shows, dog shows, with our two Samoyeds. These sled dogs keep us healthy day by day. I garden and cultivate house plants. I follow my lifelong interest in music, including playing the piano. Attend Badger basketball, cheer on the Cubs, and enjoy the beauty and peace of Blue Lake.